Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have back as our guest Dr. William Benston, and today we will be talking about hands-on healing, a training course in the energy cure. About a month and a half ago, we had Dr. Benston on to talk about The Energy Cure, which is his book, which outlines a number of studies that he's performed on hands-on healing in mice with breast cancer. And this is a Sounds True CD set in order to help others understand the methods that were used in the people that he trained to do the healing on the animals, and perhaps could be used on humans as well. He's also researched other forms of healing, such as placing the energy in cotton and water, and outlines it on this CD set as well. Welcome, Dr. Benston.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, I learned a lot listening to your training course. Very interesting methods. I guess we'll start with a little bit of the history that got you interested in hands-on healing, which involves a healing that you had. And then I'm curious as to see how you came up with the image cycling.
Well, the way I got into this was going from clinical experience into the lab to test the clinical experience. And the real short version is that a whole bunch of years ago, I met a guy who was quite spontaneously evolving into being a healer. And actually, I was the first person he ever treated. I used to have a chronic bad back, lower back pain kind of a situation. And he put his hands on my back, and I was the first person he ever tried this on. And my back got better. And I mean, it really got better very quickly, and I've been pain-free for many decades. And so my question was, what was that about? I mean, you could take it as, well, that's a spontaneous remission, it's a coincidence, it's whatever it might be. And the options, I guess, would be either to walk away and say that was an interesting experience, or to become obsessed with trying to figure out what it is that happens when someone does something like this. And I guess I chose the latter course. I couldn't let it go because I begin as a skeptic in all of this stuff, and I try to keep myself open to data, and so I simply follow the data wherever it leads me. And then try to untangle the problem, as it were. So I really went from watching hundreds and hundreds of people undergo hands-on healing and watched certain things be affected very, very quickly and certain things not be affected so quickly and certain things not be affected at all. And I tried to take that clinical experience and see what was behind it, and so moved into the lab. And so I've been doing lab work for quite a long period of time, and actually, as we speak, I have ongoing research.
Great. Well, it's a very interesting question that you've raised in terms of why some people are totally cured with one session, why some people get better with multiple sessions, and why some people don't get better at all, and then why some people get worse. And, you know, as a healer myself, I can tell you that certain things like burns and RSD and other neuropathic issues, because I'm a hand surgeon and we see a lot of RSD and other neuropathic conditions from trauma, those will get worse initially. And if the patient can stand it, then we'll get anywhere from 3 to 7 days relief of pain over their baseline. And a lot of
when you say worse initially, you're talking about
during
their
the healing.
Symptoms, what they're feeling.
During the healing, yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah. I've run into that quite a bit. Pain often exacerbates as a result of treatment, and you end up getting cursed out. You know, I was in pain when I came. Now life is worse.
Right,
you know,
but if they can put up with it, it
yeah,
will get better.
Yeah, goes away. Yeah.
Right, it will get better for a time. I mean, usually.
Yeah.
What I found is that RSD and some of these really, really horrible neuropathic conditions have a karmic thing going on. And so you're not really allowed to take the pain away permanently. And lots of times I hear a lot of that when I put my hands on. I hear what will happen or what, you know, like, don't do this or this isn't right, you know. So I kind of know a little bit about what is going on with those cases. And then
yeah,
some
the first
patients...
Few times it,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the first few times that someone gets worse as a result of a hands-on session, it's a little startling, and I guess my initial rationalization was at least something's happening, you know.
Right. But it falls into categories. It falls into categories clinically, though. It really does. Like, you wouldn't want to lay hands on a burn patient, because adding energy to that is bad, and you don't want to lay hands on somebody who's nauseated in recovery room, because they'll throw up. But sometimes throwing up's a good thing, because then,
yeah,
you know, the nausea is relieved. So you have to have a little bit of an understanding. You're adding energy. So there's some conditions where adding energy is going to make the patient worse. But then they might be better later on. So lots of them put up with it. Because I don't know if you have followed patients for years and years with RSD, but they'll do almost anything to get relief. And narcotics don't necessarily relieve it.
Yeah, I don't have that experience.
Well, I wanted to share that with you because I think it's important to know what gets worse, and probably you should not lay hands on an acute burn.
I'm trying to, as you said that, I'm trying to remember if I've ever even tried, and I have no recollection of even trying to do it.
Well, that's one thing
I would take some issue with you in terms of adding energy to a system. That's still an open question to me. I know we call it energy healing, and actually my book is called The Energy Cure, but that's chosen by the publisher.
Right. What I'm saying is, in about 20 years of experience as a healer, the things that you don't necessarily get good results with fall into that category. They already have too much energy in the system, like nausea, burns. Now, neuropathic's different, though, because neuropathic, we could talk about that later, but neuropathic is totally different, and if the patient can stand it, you get benefit from that. But sometimes the pain gets really, really intense.
Huh.
So that's one thing. But the, you know, the things, I had a patient come to me yesterday. His wife brought him in. She said that I did one healing on her, and she's never had pain since. And I've had, and you know that can happen. But her husband, who she brought in, had really, really bad degenerative spine disease, and probably some neuropathic component, definitely radiation. He had pain down one leg, clear to his foot. And you say in your book, you shouldn't, like, if somebody has pain in their leg, you don't necessarily just lay hands on the leg. I had to lay hands on the area of the spine that was innervating the leg to get any
movement
off the leg.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. I just call it following the hands.
Right, but there's what I'm saying is there's an anatomical reason for that. The nerve is compressed up in the spine, not down in the leg, but the pain is down in the leg. And I was able to get a lot of the pain out of his leg, but not all of it. Now, you know, that is you know, you can't always relieve somebody's pain when they come in. It's just not possible. So I'm just emphasizing some of the things that you talk about in the CD set as being in my personal experience as well. So it's very good that you brought these out, because I don't know that it's been brought out in other places. I haven't really seen it. I mean, you have a lot of detail in the CD set that is true, and I'm just trying to give you some of the physiologic and anatomical basis behind the experience, because there is.
Sure.
So it's very interesting to see what findings you've had over time in your clinical work. Of course, in the mice, the thing I find most fascinating is that you put your I send energy through my left hand as well. You put your left hand and your right hand around the cage, and they gravitate and want to lay on your left hand.
Yeah,
only if they have tumors.
Yeah.
Only if they have tumors, though.
Yeah, once it's over, they don't want to have anything to do with you. So we spin the cages so that there's not a set that we're always putting our hands in the same place where the mice have to congregate. So then they jockey for position, who gets to get closer to the left hand, and they sometimes take turns.
And that's true the opposite way, too. I do a lot of breast surgery, and I have patients who go home, and they say, the weirdest thing happened. This cat that we have that will never come close to people came and laid on my chest, and he's never done that before. And I go, well, isn't that, I mean, that's just the opposite, though, that another living form that normally is standoffish will come and lay on a surgery site. I think it's fascinating. I do too.
Animals tend to gravitate towards you when you're treating, and I'm not a particularly strong cat lover, but cats love me when I'm doing it.
There you go.
It annoys me.
It annoys you. I bet it annoys the mice too.
Yeah, well, you know.
Just kidding. I know you do those experiments in labs, but some of the really interesting things that you brought up in both the book and the CD set is that a person's belief system can, either way, really believing in healing or really disbelieving in healing, can affect the outcomes of these experiments. And I really loved it when you put the little thing in where you you had him take a mouse home with breast cancer. You want to explain that to the listening audience? Because I think that's fascinating.
Well, the reason that we took mice home in one of the experiments was I was trying to figure out if I could really nail down that healing can be taught.
Right.
And although it is the case that almost all healers were taught, it is also the case that we have no pre-post tests of teaching efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
So people out there who are healing have been taught by somebody, but we don't know, for example, whether they can do it before. And we also have a situation in my experiments where you're treating one particular mouse, but a whole bunch of mice get cured that are not in the cage. And so we have this spillover effect. I call it resonant bonding, but you're treating one cage of mice, and mice all over the place are getting cured. And so what I wanted to do in one experiment was to find out, can everybody really do this? And so I had everybody having to treat two cages of mice. And we had five people, and they all lined up on a lab bench in a traditional laboratory, and they had to come in once a day and treat their mice. And I assumed that if any one of the five people could heal, then all of the five mice would get cured. But they also had to come, and we synchronized this, and pick up a cage of mice that nobody else saw and take them home. So everybody had to spend some time with a home mouse, and everybody had to spend some time with a lab mouse. And the question was, could everybody do it at home? That's the way I was thinking. Because obviously, if one out of the five could do it in a lab, and the cages were right next to each other, they'd all be cured. So I didn't know if I could say it was Joe or it was Sally who did it. And so Joe and Sally had to prove themselves by being a solo project at home.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened instead was very, very, very perplexing. Everybody cured their mice at home.
Mm-hmm.
And in the lab, the biologist mice died.
Isn't that amazing?
And the control mice in that experiment, which were only seen by the biologists, they all got cured.
That is just incredible.
Yeah, that made me scratch my head for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then I finally came up with this idea of fluid resonant bonding. And by fluid, I mean bonds can be made, bonds can be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way that we have the experience of connection and lack of connection, that's fluid. So you can feel connected to a person and then not connected another time,
mm-hmm.
connected to a place and then not connected another time.
Mm-hmm.
You can be connected to an idea. And so everybody in the audience has clearly felt connection and lack of connection.
Right.
And so I thought perhaps this connection, maybe there's something to this connection.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if you're in a particular state of mind, you can break that connection.
Like if you try too hard?
I think experimentally it's held up that the biologists in the lab become intellects.
Right.
They put on their little white coats, and they get their little calipers, and they're measuring their tumors mm-hmm. even as they're putting their hands around the cage, and they're doing all that. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually served to break the bond.
Right.
They didn't have to go through all of that when they looked at the control mice.
They were just curious. Yeah, they were just curious.
They were just curious. They just kind of looked in, and once they looked in, all those mice started to go into remission.
So it may not take very long, because didn't you say some of the biologists were just there for like a few minutes?
Oh, yeah. The controls have been seen for as short as, I don't know, I couldn't really quantify, certainly not more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And that simple experience of running into a cage, looking at, mm-hmm. and just kind of, I don't know, something goes click, I think connects them. And so what we're talking about here is not a healing experience, mm-hmm. but rather an experience that connects you to a larger whole.
Right.
So I don't think it's right to conclude that 5 minutes will cure all the stuff. I think the question is, how do you connect? And once you connect,
right, when you're doing your healing in the other room,
you're healing everything.
Mice. Right. I think that's probably true.
So I have, for example, in one experiment, I have 25 mice. In another experiment, I have 75 mice.
Mm-hmm.
The 75 mice get better faster because there's simply more treatments that are necessary to do 75 mice.
Right.
And I think if you're treating any cage, you're treating all of them.
Yeah. I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
So how do we use that to help people?
Well, there's a whole bunch of ways you could do this. To help people, you can go, I would say, the traditional route of healing and go person to person to person to person.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that's probably the dominant model. Another way you could help people would be to see if, in fact, there is a value added to teaching healing. And that would be, can I do a pretest, see what people are able to do? Can I do a post-test? I think it's very, very interesting to try to find out whether different healing, I don't know what the right word is, modalities or techniques, produce mm-hmm. different results. So, for example, can you do something I can't and vice versa? And can we nail that down to figure out what it is that you do differently than me? I think that's a really interesting way to go. And the final way I think that you can go is to see if we can get the underlying mechanism that's going on when healing occurs and see if that can be reproduced without all of the, I guess we'll just loosely call it energy work. And right. So I'm actively pursuing that also. So, for example, in the case of mice, we know that the mice get cured for life. And we know that the mice are immune to further injections of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that we can take a piece of a remitting tumor, transplant that into a fully infected mouse, and it'll cure that mouse.
That's
pretty interesting.
That is really
interesting. And no healers know about these stuff. This is all post hoc kind of stuff.
Right, right.
And so there is, I think it's extremely likely that when you do the kind of anomalous healing, we'll just call it that, or non-traditional healing, or mm-hmm. alternative healing, whatever the term might be, I think that when this is done, and obviously it's successful, and you can see the success either in the symptoms or the final cure of, or
mm-hmm.
whatever it might
right.
be, that there is a real biological correlate going on. So you talk about relieving the pain and relieving the neurological problem. Well, let's take that at face value. So the question is, what was the process that nerve or nerves went through, and can that be reproduced?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, using healing as kind of a, let's reveal what the body already knows.
Right.
And then can we replicate that? So one of my goals is to see if we can reproduce the mice cancer remissions without my healing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
By trying to, I guess, dissemble the process and see if
right.
we can get it to begin. And what that form will take, I don't know. Now, if that works, then I think you have the possibility for widespread application of healing that can bridge maybe the alternative and the traditional fields a little bit more readily, so that you physicians, and I don't mean you, but you know, that physicians don't get so antsy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be kind of neat to say, wow, this came from healing?
Yeah. I think there's two major concepts that are involved here. One is maybe three because of the cotton, but we'll get to that in a minute. One is the field effect, and you have a real good explanation of that when you explain the placebo effect, which is not a mind-body thing at all. But the placebo effect is a field effect whenever you have an intent during an experiment. And that, I think, understanding the placebo effect is important to reaching the goal of figuring out how to, you know, to disassemble healing.
Yeah, and I completely agree.
Yeah, and then the second thing is frequencies. Obviously, when we are laying hands on, we are transmitting frequencies. However, we're not consciously doing it. You know, we don't say, I'm now going to give the frequency that's going to cure this cancer and this rat. We're not doing that. What we're doing is we're just standing there, and that's when cycling comes in, and you can talk about that in a minute. But frequencies are coming in, and this has been measured. Dr. Norm Shealy measured gigahertz energy coming out of the healer's hands. So
yeah.
It has to do with frequencies, and probably different frequencies for different healings, I would imagine. I mean, probably have to test.
Well, I think it's more than just frequencies. You also need a carrier wave of some sort. And,
right.
Because the stuff doesn't seem to diminish with distance, and that's
right.
One of my concerns about using the word energy.
Well, but energy doesn't just have to be in that realm. There's scalar energy as well, and scalar physics is not limited to one dimension. So
that's perfectly possible.
Yeah, so
perfectly possible.
I mean, I was involved with a lot of physicists and engineers that were experts in scalar technology, some of which worked with the government. And scalar is probably the basis of hands-on healing. I mean, that's one of the concepts you have to enter into to understand it, because you're right. It is not limited by space or time. Therefore, it cannot be explained by our normal physics. But
yeah, when you say energy,
scalar,
you tend to think of...
Yeah, there's scalar physics, and if you understand that, it fits in very nicely. But
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about just a little bit about the cotton, and then come back to cycling. We'll come back and talk about it.
Okay.
But the cotton, tell them about your experience with the used cotton, because that is the other the transfer of this energy in another direction backward into you.
Well, the cotton stuff came, what was really inspired by Bernard Grad's work at McGill University.
Mm-hmm.
And way, way back, and I think all roads lead to Grad in one way or another, in the 50s and 60s, Grad was the pioneer at McGill. In particular, I think, testing the Hungarian healer Oscar Estebany.
Mm-hmm.
And Estebany claimed, and Grad tested, can you in fact store, we'll call it X, in materials. And
right.
Grad found in his wound healing experiments and his plant growth experiments and all the other kind of lab work that he did that it didn't seem to matter whether Estebany was actually putting his hands around, say, a cage of mice and trying to make their wounds heal faster, or whether he held cotton and the cotton was applied, or whether he even held the shavings that go in the bottom of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
That would also produce it. Or whether he held the water that was fed to the mice.
And that, by the way, is called holy water, and we've had it
forever.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah. And it actually turns out that chemical tests of when Estebany held it were the first demonstration of something real and profound that happened to the water. I don't know what it means, but the bond angle of the water had changed.
Right. I read
the
experiment.
Yeah, so why changing bond angle would change what the water can do is still, you know, unknown, but
right.
it's clearly the case that something profound happens.
There's a physical effect
of
the water.
Physical implications,
right.
And changes the physical world and
mm-hmm.
and everything else. So I think that's a, you know, really a done deal. So Grad looked at what does cotton do, what does water do, what are the shavings in the bottom of the cage do if you hold them, and all this kind of thing. So taking that as a kind of a inspiration, I started to do that with if you hold cotton. And can you use it for cotton? Can you use cotton, treat it as if you were treating a person or treating a cage, and what happens if the cotton is applied? And there seems to be pretty good anecdotal evidence. I don't have it really nailed down, but it seems to be pretty good anecdotal evidence that cotton is a good medium for storage. Water is a good medium for storage. We did some experiments with mice where one of the cages, nobody saw them who knew the healing techniques. Rather, water was treated, and that was fed to the mice, and the mice were cured. Now, initially, I thought that might be due to the water, but the resonant bonding thing is a kind of a methodological confound. So I'm not really sure yet whether it was the water or it was just that this became a bonded cage that got better with all the other cages.
Right.
So the cotton stuff not only seems to be a nice surrogate, a storage medium, but it also, just anecdotally, seems to take on the characteristics of the thing it's treating. And this is a little disturbing, and this found out quite by accident. So the story you're referring to is a case where someone used cotton, and this was a clinical, someone used cotton to apply to a tumor. The tumor went away, but if we, I actually did hold the cotton like a year and a half later, not knowing that this was the piece of cotton, and it had the characteristics of the condition in it. I don't know how else to put it.
Mm-hmm.
You could feel actually palpable tumors by touching the cotton. So it I think it stores. You know, I mean, I really think it stores.
So we have
it's
to
not
be
a
careful.
Thing.
And throw the cotton away once it's used.
Throw the cotton away after you use it.
Right,
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, this got my attention. Cotton's not just cotton hanging out.
Okay, so cotton, it can go both ways is the thing.
It goes both ways, yeah. So
right, and I think that's important to understand
because
healers...
The water that takes on the characteristics of the... Get rid of the water.
That's right. And healers can also take on the characteristics of the patients they're healing.
Absolutely. Yep. And you can take on the symptoms, you can take on a whole bunch of things. And I don't know, I think there's some dispute, I don't know your opinion, but I think there's some dispute as to whether that's a dangerous thing to do or not. I don't find it dangerous. I find it actually interesting and then sometimes annoying.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've seen where healers have gotten tumors, including cancer, but then got rid of it. So my opinion is you can get rid of it very quickly if you get it that way. But, you know, because it's not really yours. But... I hardly ever get backaches or headaches, but if I'm in Walmart or in some other crowded place with a bunch of people and I get a headache or backache, I know it's not mine. And I can clear it very quickly, but I know it's not mine because I simply don't get those things unless I wear
I don't either.
Headlight.
And I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm completely with you on that.
So
taking on the symptoms. Now, on the other hand, I know somebody who teaches healing has her own institute, actually, in California, and she is... really adamant about, you know, healers should never do this, and it's dangerous, and, you know, she's flopping around and to make sure this never happened. I don't know. It just never bothered me.
Well, she's probably got some legal, you know, liability.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Never bothered me in the slightest.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time it happened, when I didn't see it coming, when you take something on, it's a little disconcerting.
It's a little disconcerting for a little bit, Well, basically, though, you can clear yourself. There are methods to do that. You can wash your hands. You can just... you know, clear yourself with intent, and usually those things go away.
And very quickly, too. So once you realize that it's not really you, I think it takes the startle out of it.
Yeah. I did have two, well, I had one experience I want to share with you and one experience I'm going to share with you later after I do it. But we had a lot of hand patients, like I said, so I bought these cloth water bags. And then we put distilled water in them, and then we did healing on them. And the patient said it felt wonderful. Whenever they put the healing, the hot water bottle on their hand, they had relief of the symptoms. So that was, we did that probably, I don't know, around 2000. And then the thing, I love the thing about the cotton, so I got a roll of cotton, and I'm having everybody I know who can charge things charge it up, including me, and I'm going to have surgery in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to put the cotton on the surgery site. How's that?
Oh, beautiful.
I'll tell you how it works.
Beautiful. Now, do you get the same symptom that I do, that it when you hold cotton, at least when I put it in my left hand, it almost, it turns on the hand automatically?
Yeah, it does, especially if you're doing other things. Like, I was running around my office. I have a really big office. It's like 10,000 square feet, so you can really run around. And I was doing all this stuff, and I was holding the cotton in one hand. And then I come around the corner, and there's, like, one of the most remarkable healers in this part of the country. He stops by my office sometimes. He's worked, you know, he's been tested at, in all these laboratories, and he's actually was up this last week at Duke being tested. And I said, "Here, hold this in your left hand."
Yeah.
I got him to charge it up for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I had anecdotally, I had a very, very strange experience, which I think I mentioned in the CDs. And that is, I was sitting once home treating some cotton to be shipped to somebody, mm-hmm. and the phone rang. And normally I don't answer the phone, you know, if I'm doing something else. But I kind of got up and I start walking. And as soon as I started to move, mm-hmm. I got a jolt.
Yeah.
And movement, it's almost indescribable how much movement, even slight movement, mm-hmm. increases at least the subjective sense of power. And I don't know what to do with that. So I've tried to figure that out. So you can sit down, hold the cotton in your left hand, and just kind of move your hand in any, doesn't make mm-hmm. any difference what direction, even gently, and I feel a change in the hand. And I've given this now to dozens of other people to try, and they all report the same thing.
Yeah, you know, when I'm doing hands-on healing, though, I do move my hand in a clockwise motion almost always, rather than just sit there and hold it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you might, I don't know if you're still doing your mice experiments, but you might have them move their hand, not just
yeah.
hold it.
Yeah, it's a really,
it's
particularly strong, or at least I sense it as particularly strong when I do cotton. Now, trying to figure that out, I've walked with cotton on a treadmill, mm-hmm. trying to see if that it doesn't do it. I've taken it on a plane with me and pulled out mm-hmm. cotton. You know, I'm going 400 and something miles an hour, and
yeah.
there's no sensation at all. But if I move my hand gently on the plane, mm-hmm. it happens again.
Mm-hmm.
But not being on the plane, not being in a car, not walking
right.
along on a treadmill. It's kind of weird. Haven't been able to untangle it.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but I think that is true. Although, you know, why that is, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to find out. Can't crack it yet.
Yeah, we talked a little bit before when we were doing the energy cure about how scalar waves, if you put one hand on one side of a tumor and one hand on the other side of a tumor, in a person, in a mice, whatever, in a dog, you're creating a scalar wave, okay, between your two hands. That humans have an ability to do this for some reason. And the animals may, too. We don't know. But anyway, they've measured scalar waves between two hands, and that it may be that turning the tumor into normal tissue has something to do with changing the polarity of the nucleus of the cells. That's something that's been found. And so if you put all this together, we've got the scalar waves are important, fields are important, intent is important. And one of the things I was wondering, and I don't know how easy it would be to do this, if you could hold the intent only to cure the mice that are in front of you, whether or not you could actually decrease the number of control mice that would
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question.
Because we talked about this last time, and then I thought about it.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's that's absolutely. I got to put that on the pile of things to test because can you stop it? You know, can I be that selective? I know it goes in the reverse.
Yeah.
There are in my various experiments there have been control mice that I didn't know about.
Right.
So the biologists are playing tricks on me. So they say you'll treat the mice in experimental room one and experimental mm-hmm. room two, and then I find out there's four other rooms where there are mice,
right.
and they all get cured. Then they tell me there's one control group that's, you know, in about 100 meters from you,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't tell me they have a second control group.
Right.
And they get cured too. And so the bonding, the linkage among the cages is a real interesting phenomenon, and again, one of those things you want to try to figure out. But yours is really the inverse of that. Uh-huh. Could I deliberately withhold?
Right.
Yeah, it's a great question.
And if, you know, if not, maybe you could do it with different colors of mice, you know. Like if you had brown mice as your experimental group, but white mice as your control group, and then intend only to cure brown mice. You might have to do something. Yeah, it's a lot easier to meditate if you have a one-pointed focus than it is nothing at all. But the other thing I wanted to say, too, it's pretty well shown accepted that skeptics, really real skeptics that don't believe in anything, can mess with experiments. You've read that sort of information.
Well, I take issue with your use of the word skeptic. I've spoken to skeptic societies.
Yeah. Well,
I'm the only skeptic in the room.
Right. No,
because
I know.
They're a bunch of believers.
Right, exactly. They're non-believers.
And they haven't heard anything I've said, but they already know that I'm full of it.
Right, right.
So those
I'm talking
skeptics.
About those guys, not true skeptics, those guys. That they can mess up experiments with their non-beliefs.
I would call it more a generic experimenter effect.
Okay.
And it turns out, if you look at a bunch of the literature on experimenter effects, that experimenter effects occur cross-discipline. You know, so it's not just the alternative medical model problem, mm-hmm. or it's not just parapsychological work. The experimenter effect and who's there for what reason and how mm-hmm. it turns out to be much, much more profound, I think, in many, many fields than we previously thought. So I would agree with you, but I'm calling it more neutrally an experimenter effect, because even if you
right.
have believers in a positive way there, sometimes a believer can mess up an experiment, and sometimes they can enhance an experiment. I don't know that it's belief per se.
Well, it's something, because I read a paper, and I'm blanking on where it was published, but it was published in peer-reviewed scientific literature. And what it said is that it's a real problem that scientists don't want to, you know, acknowledge, but that the first time an experiment's done, it is way more statistically significant in general than subsequent experiments done after.
Oh, yeah. And this is the decline effect.
Yeah.
And I just got back from the SSE meeting, the Society for Scientific Exploration, and this
mm-hmm.
is a group of people who are researchers in anomalies, and I highly recommend people check out the Society for Scientific Exploration
right.
website. But one of the talks we had at this was the decline effect.
Yeah.
And it was given by a psychologist who's been investigating the decline effect, and he's been able to mathematically model the decline effect, but it's not parapsychological work, it's any work.
Yeah. And think about that with drug research,
if you're doing drugs,
because they're not neutral.
If you're doing chemistry, there's a decline. If you're doing physics, there's a decline.
Yeah.
If you're doing parapsychology, there's a decline.
Right.
And what happens is people rarely replicate work.
Right.
Because
they're true believers when they do their first experiment.
Yeah, and I'm done. You know, where's the glory in the replication?
Right.
So it turns out that there is a mathematically modelable decline effect that goes mm-hmm. cross-discipline. And I don't know, that may or may not be related to the experimenter effect, but it's certainly there. The experimenter effect could depend on simply who's there.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, I spent some time with Jacques Benveniste in Paris at his lab, but also just before he died. Benveniste is the guy who discovered the memory of water.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't discover it, but he documented it and even had a paper appearing in Nature.
Right.
That water, in fact, has memory. He believed he could digitize the signal, transmit it over the Internet, play it to water, and it would take on the attributes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really astounding stuff. And he put in on his website called digibio.com, he put the exact protocol, and he said, okay, everybody, you know, all over, replicate this. Do step one, step two, step three, mm-hmm. step four, and see for yourself. Well, it turns out some people were able to replicate and some couldn't. And then he discovered, and he discovered this just before he died, and he was pretty crestfallen, but just before he died, he discovered that when looking over his years of data, the success or failure depended on who was in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time he was able to replicate, but sometimes he couldn't.
Right.
And it turns out there would be, for example, a particular technician who was very important to the success of the experiment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if the technician was in the physical building, didn't have mm-hmm. to have anything to do with the experiment.
Yeah.
If he was present, the memory of water was stronger.
Right.
And he was horrified at this. And I said, because he was thinking, you know, I had a, you know, he had something
right.
like as predictable as gravity. You know, you throw it up, it comes down,
yeah.
you write a simple formula, you're done. And he thought, well, I got you do step one, step two, step three,
mm-hmm.
and you got the memory of water. Anybody can do it. You know, it's an objective, separate from everybody
yeah.
Phenomenon. And it turned out it wasn't.
It has to come through a human energy field.
It comes through, yeah, people matter. And,
yeah.
and
I wonder if
and
animals
so he
matter.
Thought this was terrible, and I kept saying, this is remarkable.
Right.
You know, this could, I mean, what if this is the case no matter what you do? So if you're combining hydrogen and oxygen, maybe the characteristics change. Maybe you get more water if you're in the lab or not in the lab. Maybe it mm-hmm. depends, maybe it depends. Wouldn't that be that would be profound.
Right.
And people are starting to do that now, and it turns out it may, in fact, be very profound that the world out there isn't.
That's right. The observer is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, so our old materialist bias that says out there, the stuff that happens, it doesn't make a difference whether you do the experiment or I do the experiment, may in
yeah.
fact be not the case. That the and it may not be the question is not related to belief. There may be it might be more subtle and actually more interesting than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be the something about the human energy field and its connectivity to whatever is around it.
Yeah.
I mean, some
yeah.
people go through life and never connect with anything. We call them autistic.
Yeah, that's right.
So you need to do your experiment with some autistic people and
oh,
see if it works.
Oh, I completely agree.
I mean, really, they can't connect.
Yeah. And again, so we have put it in terms of belief. I don't know.
And
if
it may not be belief. It may
se.
Be energetic with, you know, what we're talking about between the field, between our field. But the field, you know, it's interesting because the field is more than just us. Because if we're connected to a higher field, especially a higher dimensional field, then there's really only one field, and that would be the higher dimensional field, and we're just like little holograms coming off of that.
Who knows?
We're not even real.
Who knows? Yeah. And so
we're not even here. You're not separate from me.
No, it's pretty humbling. It's actually pretty humbling.
It is. It's
yeah.
Great. Well, I think that's, you know, if you look at the teachings of the great masters, that's pretty much what they were saying.
Yeah, they're very annoying that way, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. They all say the same thing in different ways, but pretty much the same thing, and now science is headed that way, too.
And I think science is really going to start to go through a shift because the assumptions that, I mean, most of the time, most working scientists never even question their assumptions.
Right.
So, the first assumption, it's so obvious, who would even think of articulating it, that there's a world out there independent from you and me, and it has
mm-hmm.
objective properties, and if I work hard and use this method, I can figure out what those properties are. That may not be the case.
Right.
You know, that really screws things up.
It does.
Yeah.
But it opens up a lot of possibilities.
Way.
You know, it opens
yeah.
up tremendous possibilities.
Yeah,
and maybe that's why
much,
the masters always
help
said.
The textbooks very much so.
Yeah, and maybe that's why the masters always said that we're way more powerful than we ever knew.
Yeah, it could be.
Collective
could be.
We, you know, not individual we, but collective.
So if you're listing a series of facts, you know, be careful.
Yeah. That's true. That's very true. Well, yeah. This is all really wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, it really is the next great questions that science has to look at.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
So would you like to give some of your contact information for our listeners, how they can get the CD set?
The CD set is being distributed by Sounds True.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably you could go to Sounds True. I'm guessing it's SoundsTrue.com. I kind of made that up. But Sounds True Publishers in Colorado. I have a website that I'm trying to remember. BengstonResearch.com. Bengston, BENGSTON,
uh-huh.
Research, one word, .com. And I'm pretty sure that you can get to it that way. I don't really...
On the back of your CD, it says you can go to SoundsTrue.com/bonus/William, and then there's the thing that is down at the bottom rather than a dash, Bengston,
yeah.
And then thing down at bottom, Han. And that's
That sounds too hard. I think you go
you.
To SoundsTrue and just, you know, search me and you'd
yeah.
come up with Hands on Healing. So
yeah.
It's a six CD set. The six CD set, as you said, is a how-to. So it's drill and the first two I can't help myself, so I prattle on about research. But the bulk of the CD set is how-to. What exactly did I do in my experiments?
Mm-hmm.
If people want to know step one, step two, step three with drill and practice and all that stuff, it's that's really what it is.
So how did you come up with cycling? Did you come up with that, or did the healer that you worked with come up with that?
It would be difficult to just say one or the other.
Uh-huh.
It kind of, our work was blurred in the
yeah.
early years. So he had a very annoying tendency to blurt out answers, and he didn't understand what the answers meant. So you'd ask a question, he'd give an answer, and then we'd both sit there, scratch our heads, and wonder what it is he had just said. So I was curious about a lot of things, but among them was, is it possible to reproduce what he seemed to do naturally?
Mm-hmm.
And so through the short version is through many, many, many questions, this cycling model started to come out.
Right.
That we started to see what happens if people try to practice it. And we were getting really interesting anecdotes. And the thing has morphed over the years and I think been made better. So I would say we co-created the initial ones
mm-hmm.
Through question-answer, intuition, and such. And the system and the methods have morphed and grown and I hope been made a little bit better with practice, experience, and all of that. So the people who have taken part in my experiments, the volunteers, volunteer healers, come in with no experience at all, no belief in this, and I spend quite a bit of time doing the kind of exercises and teaching that you'd hear on these CDs, and then they would get their mice or whatever the task would be. It's actually pretty interesting to me. I'm curious about whether you could listen to the CDs and then go out and do this. Is it that simple? Is there more involved? These are among the questions I don't have a clear answer. So this is an invitation for people to play, try, feed in your experience. I've gotten feed-ins from people around the world who have listened to these, and they're quite startling, actually, and...
I also think that they're connecting him with the field that you and this other healer created.
And that might be too.
And I
that
think it
too.
Is very, you're able very easily to do it through either a video or a CD. That's
yeah,
what I got.
And that's where, you know, that's where we're checking out.
Because I got it would
so
be
far,
beneficial. I've been doing healing for years. But I got it would be beneficial for me to do cycling because,
yeah.
And I asked why, because, you know, I mean, why do I mean, what does that add? And the answer was because you get into this field, which is a good field to be in, you know? It's like,
yeah.
it's a more powerful field than you've generated on your own.
Yeah. And that's...
That makes sense.
People have said that. You know, so there have been people who've come from a variety of healing modalities and traditions and such who has said essentially the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting phenomenon.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I want to ask you to email me when you want to come back on the show, especially if you want to talk about some other different topics, because I think, you know, we both learn when we interview, and certainly it's of interest to me because this is the best scientific laboratory study of healing that I know about anyway. That's currently ongoing. There were some in the past, like you mentioned, in Canada.
Right.
But anyway, thank you very much for coming on, and it's been wonderful, and hope to have
we'll
you
on
back on. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have next week we have, Playing the Unified Field, Dr. Carla Hannaford. This is going to be a little bit of an extension of what we were talking about today, looking at that field that we talked about today and some of the characteristics of it. It's a fascinating book. I'm in the middle of it right now. And then on the 9th of July, we're interviewing the director of Wake Up, which is a DVD on consciousness, I know, so I haven't seen it yet. And then we have P.H. Atwater back on the 16th of July, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. And then Dr. Charles Skillis, who's a hypnotherapist here in town with a great deal of experience in some very interesting entity removal. 7/23, he'll be talking about his book, Defeat the Enemy Within. We also have Dr. Brad Gould giving a lecture at Millennium Healthcare, Healthy Food Choices and the Anti-Aging Diet. This will be at 7:30 on the 28th of June at the Dunwoody office. And then we have the Noetic Science Meeting, which is the third Thursday in July. Dr. Jeffrey Commoner will be teaching applied kinesiology and muscle testing, how you can do that for yourself, which I think is extremely important right now. Having eaten some shrimp at a local restaurant the other day and getting very ill right afterwards, but clearing it with an ionic foot bath last night, worried about the things that might be in the seafood that is coming out of the Gulf. I think that's something that we need to do. So learning how to muscle test for yourself would be advisable. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.